like with oil in Iraq, pipeline in Afghanistan. Indians and Mexicans brought out the cavalry, 'cause they were in the way of manifest destiny. Guatemala had bananas, Somalia has oil, Venezuela has democracy that we wanna spoil. Cuba has cigars and rum, Filipino sugar cane. Colombia had the isthmus and some kilos of cocaine. But now our enemies are treasonous. They tell the truth and that's serious. It's adversity, it's mockery, it's insurgency, hostility, but mostly White House sociopathology. Daniel Ellsberg was once the most dangerous man for telling the truth about the war in Vietnam. And Bradley Manning's murder footage was too graphic of U.S. conduct clearly sociopathic. It's close to blow and everybody should be knowing about corruption, the waste and abuse. Transparency is treasonous, democracy is dangerous. It's a crime to tell the truth. Edward Snowden told us all what we already knew, that the NSA is taking notes on everything we do. Is it worse that they are spying or covering up with lying with their files on where we go and with who? It's all a solo and everybody should be knowing about corruption, waste and abuse. Transparency is treasonous, democracy is dangerous. It's a crime to tell the truth. Kiriakou fingered Brennan for torture in Guantanamo. Tom Drake, the NSA, for $1 billion a dough. Jeffrey Sterling, CIA, sabotaging nuclear blueprints to Iran, they were passing. It's close to blowing, everybody should be knowing about corruption, the waste and the abuse. Transparency is treasonous, democracy is dangerous. It's a crime to tell the truth. I was on the road in Buffalo on my way to Canada to go to a gig in Detroit. Seems they had me in a file as long as a quarter mile about the songs I sing and every joint. They took my passport, put my truck in detention, and submitted me to interrogation. I escaped captivity, now only outlaws will be free, living outside the law and outside of this nation. It's also blowing, everybody should be knowing about corruption, the waste and abuse. Transparency is treasonous, civil liberties are dangerous. It's a crime to tell the truth. It's a crime to tell the truth.
Well, thank you, Tom Nielsen. That's from his latest CD, It's a Crime to Tell the Truth. And I'll tell you, that song just resonates with me, which is why we chose it as our lead-in theme. And this is Lives in the Balance Sheet. And we're going to be talking about a lot of important issues. At least they're important to us and to many of you. And we hope to have Tom as a musical guest on an upcoming program, and he can talk about, you know, his world travels and his music. And, well, you know, he's been at the forefront in organizing and songwriting to help people work against issues like water privatization, mountaintop removal, fracking, climate change, nuclear waste, toxic dumps, and incinerators. And actually, he visited us here about a year ago.
Yes, he did. He came, he does house shows, and he is wonderful. He has some of the most progressive and heartwarming songs, and songs to make you angry, and songs to inform you. And we hope to have Tom on the show in the future.
And we're going to be featuring a few musical guests who tour the country and the globe. And they're going to report back on what they're doing and what we can do to help them. As I said, this is Live in the Balance, and my name is Dave. They call me New Jersey Dave. I do live in New Jersey on the Jersey Shore, and my special co-host this week, right off the train, is Lynn, and they call her California Lynn.
Yes. Well, we hope that you enjoy our debut show. My name is Lynn, and I'm a CPA, and for the last 12 tax seasons, I've spent working at low-income clinics at the Jersey Shore, where I meet a wonderful cross-section of citizens, in addition to my private clients, and that really gives me a really broad understanding of the financial and economic issues out there facing everybody.
Remember we were at the Occupation of Freedom Plaza, and we saw Tom Nielsen, who was performing, and I just got a text from one of our listeners who said the voice is coming in through, which is really terrific, because this is the first time I've done anything quite like this, so I want to make sure that it goes along well. Anyway, we saw Tom and a lot of other musicians at Freedom Plaza. And I'll tell you, that was quite an experience for me. That was life-changing. Did you want me to do my introduction?
Yes, why don't you do your introduction?
All right. Well, as many of you know, I was physically kicked out of comedy school. And then I decided to work in real estate, and I worked in mortgage finance and mortgage loan servicing. And I've investigated mortgage fraud for the Mortgage Bankers Association of America and served as a mortgage loan servicing expert in federal courts in New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. And since 10 or 15 years ago, I worked for a nonprofit mortgage loan counseling organization, which we co-founded. And it's definitely not a HUD-approved loan counseling organization. I've written a few books on fighting foreclosure, but I wouldn't recommend anyone buy them, even though they are available for rush delivery on Amazon. The clusterfucking of the U.S. economy arising from mortgage securitization and illegitimate foreclosure has yet to be written. And the story has not fully been told. Anyway, my life changed to activism after participating in an event held at Union Square, New York. It was called Sounds of Resistance. And then the Occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. And I'm telling you, it was an extraordinary experience. And largely, I'll be talking about many of those experiences as we talk about the issues here. Well, 50 years ago, I was a kid. I cut my political teeth, as they say. I was helping spending Saturdays helping my father and my grandfather collect third-party ballot access signatures in some of New Jersey's busiest cities, Newark, New Brunswick, Camden. And that was quite an experience. So I grew up with that type of exposure and experience, and now I'm a member of various organizations, including the Green Party of Monmouth County in Central New Jersey. I'm a member of the Socialist Party of Central New Jersey, Medicare for All New Jersey, New Progressive Alliance, and People for a New Society. And I grew up in an academic environment where politics and economic systems were fair game at any family event, and they usually were. My wife could call it a political boot camp. But in the last few years, I've presented at workshops at the Left Forum, New York City, the Occupation of Freedom Plaza in D.C., and at the first two democracy conventions in Madison, Wisconsin. And through that, I have met so many fascinating and interesting people, many of whom will be guests on this program, who are much more expert in many of the issues that we face today. And what are some of those issues here?
Oh, my gosh. We got to name them all? Holy cow. Well, healthcare is a major issue. We need universal single-payer healthcare. Student loan debt, the suffocating $1.2 trillion, is another issue. We have mass incarceration. We have privatization of everything. We have austerity. We have the food stamp budget being cut by $9 billion while the wars are increased by $40 billion. And that's just in a quarter. The
We're going to talk about economic democracy as an alternative. We're going to talk about civil rights and civil disobedience. And I'd like to talk about public banking, which is so very important when we're talking about the economic, financial, you know, policies of the United States. It's basically Main Street versus Wall Street. And we'll have musical guests, you know, to talk about their music with the message. I know one fellow I'd like to call in to talk about Common Core education, or indoctrination, as many people think. Fracking and fracking waste. Did you know that they're trying to get rid of fracking waste by going to cash-strapped municipalities and selling this crap as road salt, you know, for the winter?
Not surprised. They are very, very creative and very ingenious in how they manipulate our thought process into thinking that something that's very bad for us could be very good for us. They're very, very good at that. I mean, the number of wars we're in is, you know, by it stands on its own as evidence of that.
And we need to talk about combat veterans and their welfare.
Exactly,
and
of course.
We have some folks that want to come in and talk about minimum wage and their group 15 now, which is gaining a lot of steam and putting a lot of pressure, you know, across the United States. We'll bring in an economist or two to talk about a peace economy versus a war economy and the military-industrial complex. And I know we've each had individual battles with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, so we'll be able to shed some firsthand information on, you know, how they work. And
so how did I get into this?
So, oh, yes, dear, how did you get into this?
Oh, okay, all right. Well,
talk about bogarting here.
Well, I come from a very conservative background. My grandfather fought in World War I and was one of 14 survivors of the Battle of Bois d'Ormond. I know that because when he came home, he was pissed off and he wrote a book about it called Other Men's Lives. And he dedicated his life for the next, he died in 1944, for the next several decades to finding out what went wrong in World War I. He was captain of Company B, and he was ordered to take his men into battle, which he did at the orders of his commanders, and they were pretty much annihilated. When I read his book when I was in high school, I didn't really look at it as a book against war. I was not in that mindset. This was even during the Vietnam War. But as I got older, I realized that his message was pretty clear. And I'm indebted to that. And I'm only here because he was one of 14 survivors, as my dad, his youngest, was born 10 years after my grandfather came home from World War I, which was, as they promoted it, the war to end all wars. And yet, here we are 100 years later in more wars.
So he was pretty good at finding foxholes.
To put World War I in perspective, I believe it was about a death, one casualty every 10 seconds for the duration of the war, and the war lasted 4 years. But on another show, we will talk about war, we will talk about World War I. I guess my baptism into awareness or awakening really was when I married Dave and I met his father, who Dave had talked about. And as soon as I said, I do, his father, Walter Petrovich, deployed me to the political boot camp, his political boot camp, where I learned for the next 30-plus years a lot about how everything works.
So that's your introduction. So where do we go from here?
Well, let's talk about why we wanted to have Lives in the Balance Sheet. I hear a lot of people say that they saw it on the news. They get their information from the news. And I always cringe when I hear that.
What kind of news?
They just say news. and I usually cringe, and it's usually parroting something that is on one of the major channels. And I don't think that most people are aware that 90% of our media, TV, magazines, radio, newspapers, billboards, are owned and controlled by a handful of corporations. I mean, you look and you might have 300 channels, but if you have 300 channels and they're controlled by, you know, six entities, and they're all really showing the same thing over and over again, maybe with a different word or two in it, I'm not sure how that is getting you the information you need.
We call that, or some people call that, a fawning corporate media.
Yeah, they certainly are. 2 years ago, I was called for jury duty, and I sat in the courtroom for hours watching as my fellow summoned citizens went into the box to be questioned by the judge. One question the judge asked each person was, do you think the judicial system is fair? And I'll tell you, 100% all said yes. 100%. And I thought, wow, with all that's going on, people think our judicial system is fair. And this is because these people haven't read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. They haven't watched the aggressive prosecutions of Bradley Manning or Adam Schwartz, who took his own life. They haven't seen what happened to Emily Yates in Philadelphia, an Iraq veteran who was arrested in the park. And another example of our absolute injustice that's going on is the tinderbox going on in Ferguson, Missouri, as we all wait for the outcome of the grand jury. These citizens are upset, of course, over the death of Michael Brown, but they're also upset over decades of war, of being criminalized by the justice system just for being poor. And that is the underlying anger that's going on. I mean, our news, day in and day out, it consists of weather, traffic, sports, and Hollywood gossip. It's actually newsertainment, and always, always, always a call to send more troops, more arms, more military, more fighting, more war.
You know, Tom Nielsen has a song just about that.
He does.
It's called That Was the Week.
That's right.
And he talks just about that, and I hope that he consents to playing it. On an upcoming show.
That is very good.
Well, we have basically newscasts that distribute information that is lacking. Let's call it lacking. And as a matter of fact, we pretty much stopped paying any close attention to, you know, corporate mainstream or lamestream news a couple of years ago, because quite frankly, as you said, it's all entertainment. If it's not entertainment, it's not on the news. So we have independent news, which people can easily find, and it's interesting. You know, you don't have to believe every shred that's printed or spoken or aired, but it does present plausible alternatives to what we're hearing, and you really have to use your own common sense.
And it's very difficult. Not very difficult. It's somewhat difficult to find that independent news because you might not realize which one you want to go to. You know, should I go, which news outlet? People ask me all the time, where should I go to get news? How come you know about that and I don't? There's been a big push to get inoculated for the flu vaccine. And someone asked me, are you going to get the flu vaccine? And I said, hell no, I'm not getting the flu vaccine.
No.
And yeah, and I said, well, you know, basically because I think it's toxic. I think there are side effects to it that are not disclosed in the news. And certainly, I believe it's called Guillain-Barr syndrome, which is a side effect of the flu, which is a polio-type illness. I know at least two people that have gotten it from the flu shot. There are many. In fact, if you go on the Justice Department website, now I'm going to talk about the Justice Department website. If you go on the Justice Department website, there is a whole printout of the cases of the people who have sought monetary compensation for the devastating effects some of our inoculations that are out there. So, no, I'm certainly not going to be getting the flu shot.
One of those conspiracy nuts?
I don't eat animals. I will have nothing to do with our violent and horrific meat production.
Oh, you don't eat animals? Did you like that stew tonight?
Uh-huh. No stew here.
Where are the cats?
Yeah. So we, if you, you know, take care of what you eat, I think for the most part you will be a lot healthier.
And we're going to talk about factory farming and manufactured, genetically modified organisms. We're going to have some folks that are very, very passionate. There are so many people out there that are passionate about one or two specific issues, and they advocate so forcefully and passionately about an issue or two. And what I've come to learn in the 50 years that I've been exposed to this is that these causes are all rooted in the same problem. So we have all these issues that we were talking about earlier on that we're going to explore during the coming months. They're all symptoms. They're all symptoms of a system that is in decay. We have massive unemployment. We have, you're going to talk about student loan debt. In fact, the third of the show was going to talk about student loan debt and the insidious practices that basically have enslaved an entire class of citizens, students who are facing this debt. I think it was John Adams who said, there are two ways to enslave a nation. One is by sword, and one is by debt. And we've got debt. We have the medical debt. We have taxes.
We have credit card debt.
We have student loan debt.
But about the student loan debt, that is, I am convinced it's by design. It is totally unnecessary. Higher education college is no longer about higher education. When you look at the numbers, it is really about feeding the coffers of the financial industry. It is about watching as a select few top administrators at colleges and universities. I'll name one off the top of my head is the University of Miami. They pay their president over $2 million a year, and she used to work for the Clinton administration. I believe her name is Janet Napolitano. But these top administrators, much like what happens in the nonprofit, we'll talk about the profit, but the nonprofit hospital complex, they are paid top dollars to push all kinds of policies. So these administrators are guiding young students, teenagers.
So they're not of an age where they can sign a contract?
They are not. That is a cutout. That is a student loan debt. The subject of student loan debt.
I thought you had to be 18 to sign a contract.
You do, but not student loan debt. Hmm. How about that? And that's one of the topics we're going to talk about. But it's such a large topic. It encompasses so many areas: public debt versus private debt.
I see you have a lot of notes.
Repayment versus default. The consequences of default. Rehabilitating a loan. All that has to be carved up in separate shows because there's just too much to talk about on that.
Okay.
But also, in addition to the administrators getting paid top dollars.
Brookdale is laying off 200 of their staff. That was just today.
Yeah, wow.
A local community college who is they've been in the news a lot. I think their former president is now cooling his heels in prison. I don't know if it's a jail or prison, but he's doing time. And then one of the buildings that was named after a long time.
A freeholder.
Yeah, he was indicted. And
yeah.
He passed away.
Oops.
Yeah, so there's a lot of shenanigans going on there.
And talking about shenanigans, talking about freeholders and shenanigans, in our county, first of all, let me just say that.
Oh, I have to interrupt.
Oh, dear.
I have to interrupt. Listen, this is my first show. I don't know how to work this thing. So I see we have a caller who's been on hold now for about 5 minutes. I'm terribly sorry, but I'm not going to be able to take your call because I have no idea which button to push. Now, Lynn can
push. Oh, he knows how to push buttons.
So I just ask that, if you know my email, shoot me an email or shoot me a text, and I'll try to deal with this. But next week we'll be having guests, and we will be taking calls if I can figure out which button that is. So I apologize. I should have told you that before you burned up some of your minutes. I'm sorry, Lynn. Go ahead. I didn't interrupt you.
No, Well, what I was saying is it's called Lives in the Balance Sheet because we're going to try and do the math for you and present you with the numbers, which
Isn't that the name of a song?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Lives in the Balance, that's one of our favorite songs by Jackson Brown.
By Jackson Brown, the wonderful Jackson Brown. But for those of you who don't know, or let me know what a balance sheet is. A balance sheet is a statement of financial position at a particular point in time. Okay, what does that mean? That means, just to put it simply, it quantifies what you own against what you owe. And the difference, the balance, can represent either financial strength or financial disability. So just following up on the subject of the county freeholders, in our county for the last year, I have been trying to get information from our freeholders. They have put out a lot of op-eds and letters to the editor that we must privatize our two nursing homes. We have two county-owned nursing homes, long-term care facilities, and they have put out so many articles that they must be privatized. Those are the headlines of the articles, must be privatized. And when I ask them for the financial documents, which would support their position, they claim they were losing, $8 million, $6 million, $9 million, who knows, it's different each day. When I ask them for the numbers, I was basically told they don't exist. And I said, well, the numbers, if I can't get a financial statement, if I can't see, how do you know they're losing money? And finally, I was able to get a piece of paper with numbers put on it in no particular order that showed that the homes were losing money, which basically, means nothing.
That's the way I used to hand in my assignments when I took statistics.
There you go. So then I went to the greater source, which was the county's audited financial statements, and lo and behold, there in their audited financial statements was the fact that they had very large surpluses, money left over from when they taxed the taxpayers. They taxed the taxpayers, they paid money out, and they had all this money left over. They had so much money left over at the end of each year.
That's why we need public banking.
That for the last 4 years, we have had, they had to enact a flat tax rate, the flat county tax rate, because they had so much money, above $100 million. And they were telling us they had to privatize these two nursing homes because they were losing eight, and that was their word. So, again, the numbers just didn't justify the need.
But don't we want our taxes to go to things like that?
They never put it to the taxpayers. They basically told the taxpayers they must be privatized. That's how the news works. It doesn't give you the information and allow you to figure it out. It basically tells you.
Sort of like you and me.
Okay. All right.
Well, so we know that we're going to be going down that path with you, but you're going to make it in easy-to-understand language. We're not going to need a calculator. We're not going to have to consult with other people to understand what you're saying, right?
What I'm saying about student loan debt?
Yeah, and, other things.
Of course, I will try to make it as listener-friendly, as user-friendly as possible.
So that's that. Right now, I would say that healthcare, hospital, billing practices, and student loan debt are your three hot button topics right now.
Those are my three hot topic buttons.
Yeah. Well, I only have one, and that's predatory mortgage foreclosure. And something so exciting is going on out there that going to bring some people and we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about the use of eminent domain to seize mortgage notes that are toxic. Mortgage notes are considered to be private property and subject to seizure. So, you know, for public good. So, there's been a lot of talk about using eminent domain to pay off the bankers. You know, pay them off, pay them off. Well, I say that's wrong. I say they've already been paid and they shouldn't be paid again. And in fact, the use of eminent domain can really force their hand and expose the illegal practices. And I'll just call it the shenanigans. And by these alleged lenders, we'll call them gangster bankers, but they're putting together, you know, they're foreclosing illegally. And in some estimates, as many as 85% of all of the mortgage loans that have been written between 2002 and 2008 and a half are simply not enforceable as mortgage notes.
What does that mean?
That means they can't use the foreclosure process to separate you from your house, because the reality is that they can't prove due to all of the securitization. And that really was the heart of the subprime crisis, the securitization process, which changed the relationship between documents and admittance. I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but basically the people who are demanding money from you are not entitled to that money.
Like your neighbor is looking to sell your house.
He's doing what? Well, I hope, you know, he doesn't want a commission. But you're right. You know, it's as if we saw...
For sale by neighbor.
Right.
Right.
Or we see a car on, you know, parked on the street and we put a for sale sign on it saying, here, you know, $400, it's yours.
And you take the $200 and you walk away.
And we write up a little piece of paper with numbers on it that don't mean anything in no particular order and say, here's your title.
Yeah, well... That's...
And then they, you know, so basically these lenders have employed, you know, thousands of people to falsify documents. They call it, you know, robo-signing, which is cute, but it really doesn't even scratch the surface of anything. So that's going to be on another show. I'm going to be very, very happy to talk to some activists around the United States who are involved in that.
And how about the New York Times article yesterday about people who have credit card debt, medical debt. Medical debt is a very large part of debt. And so they go and they file bankruptcy. And the debt is discharged in bankruptcy, the credit card. Perhaps they put the medical debt on a credit card, and it is discharged. And then
what does that mean?
It means it is you no longer are obligated to pay it. And yet what are the major financial institutions doing? Well, they're totally disregarding the fact that you don't owe that anymore, that it has been discharged, wiped away, and they disregard that, and they take that debt, and they sell it to the bottom-feeding collection entities who, in the tens of billions of dollars, who come after you and look to get you to pay on a debt that's already been discharged and that you have no legal obligation to pay.
Many people don't know that.
No, they don't.
And they're intimidated.
It wasn't covered on the news, right?
That's right.
That's right.
Well, we did have a situation like that. Can I talk about that?
Absolutely.
We had a family member, not a close family member anymore, who had negotiated a credit card repayment plan years and years ago. And she dutifully sent in her payments according to the agreement and thought that was the end of it. And then years later, she received notice that, by the way, you still owe this debt. She said, oh, no, I kept records. And look, well, they took her to court. And that scared
a very large, powerful law firm.
Yeah. That scared the bejesus out of her. And
which isn't easy to do.
No. But good thing we had corporate. So we used a tactic. We offered to help her because as part of the nonprofit family that we work in various places, we said, sure, we'll help you, and we devised a defense with the help of a recent law school graduate, put it together, and basically scared the bejesus out of the offending lending organization that was trying to shake us down.
Talk about turning the tables, boy.
And so within a couple of days, you know.
Immediately.
Immediately.
As soon as the law firm got the demand letter, they called up our relative and said, no need to come to court tomorrow, we're dropping the case.
And that's essentially the same type of strategy that we use with mortgage closure, but people are so intimidated, they're so embarrassed, they're so afraid. You know, they're under such emotional as well as financial stress. They think with knee-jerk reactions instead of, you know, saying, well, let's see where we are, what are our strategies, what do we want to accomplish, and how do we do that? And they're so intimidated. I don't know if this statistic is, I'm just going to make this up. 85% of the people who face mortgage foreclosure stick their head in the sand, and they wait until it's too late, and they really don't. They're not told their options because, the HUD-approved counseling organizations who are paid by the lending industry, you know, they're not going to say, oh, by the way, you can challenge your lender because they're cheating you. You know, they don't tell them that. They say things like, well, you know, get rid of your second car or go live with your parents or you know,
cut the cable bill. Yeah, I've got to cut
don't
the cable bill.
Don't eat out as much.
Yeah.
You know, do you need that many cats?
Yeah. Carpool, you know, yeah.
People say that to us a lot. Do you need that many cats? Well, listen, I'm looking at the clock here, and I see we have about 20 minutes to go, so why don't you jump in with student loans?
Okay, I'm going to jump in with a primary on student loans.
I'm
going to
go have a beer.
I'm jumping in with a primary on student loan debt. Like I said, there are so many areas to talk about, and we will cover each area on subsequent shows. But I wanted to talk about the fact that I talk to a lot of people with student loan debt. I talk to grandparents. I talk to parents. I talk to kids, of course. And I have tax clients who have come to me and said, my son went to flight school, and he spent 3 years doing that, and he's got $90,000 worth of debt, and I just refinanced my house and paid it off. Another client had a child go to photography school, 2 year photography school, $70,000. I mean, these numbers are incredible. Those are some of the more extreme cases, but the students that I talked to, the recent graduates, I can say without a doubt, they have no idea how they got into this debt. No one at high school, apparently, no one in high school gave any counseling on student loan debt. No one at colleges clearly gave any counseling on student loan debt. No one in the community. And as a matter of fact, I think that if it is never talked about on any TV program, any news, any show, they do not discuss student loan debt at all. So I wanted to give some facts on that. The most common student loan debt that we're going to talk about graduates now, not grandparents and parents. The most common student loan debt is what's called the direct loan. And that is a loan that is given by the federal government, okay? So, and the federal government, right now, direct loans or federal loans have just about topped $1 trillion. We have $1.2 trillion in total debt, according to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The other $200 billion is in private debt.
Who's getting the interest on that?
Well, we're going to talk about that, which is a whole another show on private debt. Of the federal loans, there is a maximum amount that students can borrow each year. So let's just create a fictitious person and walk this person through so we can see how we get to this debt. Let's call her Sally. And Sally wants to go to college. So Sally knows that she
may go to Sally may.
Sally may go to college. And she knows that she's trying to figure out how she's going to afford college. Well, she can get federal loan. Okay, but she can only get a maximum amount of federal loan. The interest rate right now on federal debt is fixed, and for an undergraduate, it's a little over 4.5%, and for a graduate, it's a little over 6.2%. So anyway, and there's also fees associated with these loans of 1%. Now, as far as the undergraduate, Sally knows that she's going to start college. She can only borrow in 4 years. She can only borrow $27,000. That's in 4 years. Okay, so that's $5,500 the first year, $7,500 the second year, and balance in the third or fourth year. So she knows she's got $27,000 to spend.
But that'll pay for like half a semester to show school?
Well, if we look at the cost of college, and we look at the college you mentioned, which was Brookdale Community College. It's a community college in New Jersey. It's a two-year college where you would get an associate degree, and a lot of parents are thinking, well, you know what? Or students, I'll just go to community college and then I'll transfer those credits. Oh, okay, that's a good thought.
Well, I did that.
Well, how much was a credit at Brookdale when you went, David? What year was it?
It was in the early 80s. You're mouthing something to me. I don't know what you're trying to. You're putting words in my mouth. It was in the 80s, I'm sure, early 80s, maybe late 70s. And I believe at that time the credit hour cost $13 plus books.
Yeah, wow.
And I remember my first year, you know, my freshman year, that was the longest 6 years of my life.
Well, that could be part of what your problem is there. But now, if you go to the Brookdale Community College website, it is $118.75 a credit.
And, plus books.
Well, plus a fee of $28.50, a 24% fee.
On each credit?
On each credit. So that brings the total credit up to $147.25.
So $150.
$150 a credit. So we went from $13 to $150. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go on their website, if you do the math, it doesn't match, because if you go to their website, they will tell you that to go to Brookdale Community College for a year, it's $5,544 for the tuition. Plus, you add in books, they say it's $1,200, and you have to commute, so you got to throw in gas and tolls and, you know, commuting. So that is another $800. So when all said and done at the community college, it's $7,500 per year. Okay, so it's $7,500. Let's just say $7,500 a year, but Sally is only getting $5,500 a year if she qualifies for all that, if she qualifies for that amount. So she's still $2,000 short at a minimum per year. So what's Sally going to do? Well, she's going to take out a private loan. She's going to borrow from her parents.
She could work at a strip club.
She might work someplace. So right from the get-go, there is not enough money on the borrowing level to pay for community college. And this is talking about not living there. This is commuting. So then, let's say Sally looks at a four-year college, maybe Rutgers. Rutgers is a four-year state college. And
we don't know too many people that finish in 4 years, though.
Well, if she were to go, her tuition to commute would be $13,700 a year. Well, she's only getting $5,500. She's already short, over $8,000.
And taking the train.
I mean, when you add in travel and books to that tuition, she per year is $10,000 short on what she needs to pay for tuition. And again, this is what pushes kids who really want to get an education, they want to go to college, they want to improve their lives, but now they're faced per year with a $10,000 shortfall, and they have to make that up. And the most manipulative way, which are pushed through financial aid offices, is for them to get a private loan. A private loan is
from like dad or brother.
I wouldn't think dad and brother would be as bad as a private loan from a bank or from the school.
Oh, so.
Or from a New Jersey Class loan. They would be. Those are what I would consider toxic loans, because a private loan does not have the same characteristics as a federal loan. And
you mean protections?
A lot. They don't have
protections.
Well, most of the student loans do not have a lot of consumer protections. The consumer protections are stripped for most of the loans. They are very difficult to discharge in bankruptcy.
And from the get-go, if a 17-year-old can enter into a debt obligation, a contract. I mean, that's
they can
right off the bat.
Right.
Where are the consumer protections?
There are certain tenants that you must have, certain properties that you must have to enter into a contract, and a student loan agreement is a contract. You have to have, I don't know them all off the top of my head, but you have to have capacity. You have to be
consideration.
You have to be of age. You have mutual understanding, and those are the basic tenets of contract law. And yet, in student under student
meeting of the minds,
well, these kids are so desperate to go, they kind of sign on the line, and then they go.
Well, they're promised, you know, if you undertake this debt and get this education, you're going to have a good job, you're going to have a nice life, and this is what you must do.
Well, that's true. That's what they're promised. But we're going to talk about private loans in another program because that is a whole other ballgame.
You're thinking I'm going to have you back.
So let's continue on Sally's path,
all right,
shall we? So Sally decides whichever one she goes to, she's going to use her $27,000 that she has. She has to use it because if she wants more than an associate's degree, she would take her credits from the community college and perhaps transfer them to a four-year college. So she's gonna go through her $27,000 worth of loans. So
do they charge her anything to transfer those credits?
They could. Mm. The minute Sally takes out her first loan, the interest starts ticking. But she's only 17 or 18 years old, and she's a freshman in college. And the minute that she takes it out, it's got interest going on it. There are subsidized versus unsubsidized loans. A subsidized loan means that the federal, this is according to the federal government, pays the interest while you are in college. So let's think about that. You get a federal loan, and it's subsidized, meaning the federal government pays the interest while you're in college, but the loan is from the federal government. So is the federal government writing a check from itself to itself? It is not. It is basically an interest-free loan. But they don't say that. They don't tell you it's an interest-free loan. They say they pay it, like, to make that sound so, you know.
Magnanimous.
Oh, my God. Isn't that great? They're paying it. By the way, they're paying it with your taxpayer dollars anyway. Yeah. So anyway, on Sally's path, she has subsidized and unsubsidized loans. So just crunching a couple of numbers here, let's say Sally graduates in 4 years. Let's say, Dave, she graduates in 4 years, not your scenario before where they don't. 4 years. Sally's done. She gets out. Federal loans allow her a six-month grace period. Kind of get her feet on the ground, figure out what she wants to do.
We have Sally. We have Grace.
We have Sally and Grace. And so she doesn't have to pay back her $27,000 until 6 months down the road.
Begin repaying,
right. So if you take, so the direct loan program, which, and I'm stressing this because these are the loans predominantly that young people have, are the direct loans. They are the ones that are most affordable and the easiest to get for kids entering college, even though they are totally insufficient to pay for college education, as I've just outlined, between community and four-year. So she gets out. She's got the $27,000. She's got the six-month grace period before she has to begin repayment. And then the trouble starts. She is assigned one of 11 federally authorized student loan servicers. And these student loan servicers, the largest of which is Sallie Mae, which just went through a large transformation. They created a new entity called Navient to take all of the Sallie Mae federal student loans. And what Sallie Mae is going to do is, well, you know, just basically give out private loans. They're going to try and get predatory credit cards to college students. I mean, all the shenanigans that kids certainly don't need. Well, that's what Sally Mae is going to do now. So Navient now has the student loans that Sally Mae used to have. It's kinder and gentler name. It's not two words. It's one word. It begins with an N. It's nicer. You know.
So it's the N word.
Oh. So you have your loan is assigned to a student loan servicer. And that student loan servicer, no matter what you do, has all the power. And they will do, and that is another show, a whole other show on student loan services. Let's finish up with Sally. So Sally gets out, she's assigned, let's say she's assigned to FedLoan. That's one of the 11 authorized servicers. She's FedLoan, she starts repaying her loan, and Sally goes, okay, how much do I owe? Well, the direct loans have a 10-year term payout, 10 years. So if you take her loans, you have the interest, which is accruing, that which is the interest that accrues during school is capitalized. That means it's added to the principal of the loan. So now your loan went from $27,000 to $28,000 or more, and you are paying so much per month for 10 years. So now Sally finds out she has to pay $300 a month for the next 10 years. And if Sally,
just
on that debt, $300 a month, which is $303.60 a day. And I'm going to stress in this future show how important it is to know how much your student loan debt costs per day in interest.
I know there are many students out there who want to hear about the loan forgiveness fallacy. They want to talk about student loan debt forgiveness, and those are issues you're going to touch on. Maybe you can spend about 15 or 20 minutes next week to do that.
Absolutely.
Okay, because right now, looking at the clock here, and I want to say thank you to the Progressive News Network who took a chance and agreed to have us do a show here, and especially our news director, Rick Spisak, who was very, very kind in showing me how to work. I still don't know how to work all these complicated buttons. I'm sure if anyone asked my daughter, she would say, you really ought not to have any electrical appliances or devices, but that's neither here nor there. So we want to say thank you, and it's been a pleasure. There are so many independent news sources that are out there, small, and they need to organize. From the point of news, I recommend that everyone visit popularresistance.org and make that part of your daily news diet. It's in a blog form. It's very, very informative. They also have Acronym TV, who is a subsidiary or a partner or a master or lord. And I don't know what their relationship is, but that's a terrific show.
Wonderful show.
See that. There are many great independent news outlets out there. And we're going to close the show with some more music. And it was, actually, if you go to popularresistance.org and you were to click on Creative Resistance, you will see the music video that this music is from. And it was written by a friend of ours who said he was inspired by a bumper sticker on the back of our car, which we have about 30 or 40 bumper stickers on the car. One of them said, "We are the 99, which we got when, that was a very popular expression coined perhaps by David DeGraw, who's the author of The Economics of Revolution, which is an interesting read. And you might look for it on Amazon.com. But Jim Clerico wrote this song for the 99, and he wrote it for a fundraiser that we hosted, for the rollout for a group that we work with, Expanded and Improved Medicare for All New Jersey. It was a fundraiser, and he brought his band, and they played wonderful music, very inspiring music, including this song, for the 99. And if anyone is interested, they can go to Jim's YouTube channel. It's called Sand Kicking Music, and get a taste of the Jersey Shore. But this song in particular, for the 99, I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you tune in again next week.
Thank you.
This is for the 99. We are the 99, refugees of a grand design, victims of one and the same party line. We need to give chase to the space they occupy. Hey, we're doing swell. See how we work like hell. All for Hey, Mr. Union Man, where have you gone? Won't you help us make a stand against the greedy cooperative? They took our train, ran it right into the ditch. Ain't it a bitch? Time to pull the switch. Hey, how'd you get to be so rich, Mr. Congressman? And who do you represent? Is it the 1% who pays the rent, attends every event, with a political bent, it's over the top? They tell you they're only trying to sell you somebody's vision of a dream. Oh, 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 oh. Somebody's vision of a dream. Jungle out there, give me my Medicare, give it to me now, once and for all. 'Cause we got to get our backs from up against the wall. It's all been a show, and now you gotta go. You gotta listen when history tells you so. That's when the people lead, the leaders will follow. There's nothing to confuse, just walk a mile in our shoes. Getting to know the working man's blues. But you won't hear us sounding on the Bear and Valance News. 'Cause when they tell you it's a state of mind.